All right, good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us tonight. We're going to be kicking off our program, Optimizing Treatment Outcomes and Preserving Fertility in Premenopausal HR-Positive Breast Cancer Patients. And now for our chair, we have Dr. Rebecca Schatzky.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm Rebecca Schatzky. I am the Breast Medical Oncology Team Leader at University of California, San Diego, and the Director of the Inflammatory and Triple-Negative Breast Cancer there. I have a particular interest in this topic tonight because I have an incredibly young patient population. And so preserving fertility and allowing patients to achieve their family planning goals is a really big part of my practice that I'm excited to talk about with all of you tonight and share with my wonderful colleagues here. I have Dr. Kelly McCann, MD, PhD, with me, who is at the David Geffen School of Medicine, UCLA. She's an assistant professor there and a close friend of mine. And I have the lovely Michelle Taylor, who is a nurse practitioner at Dignity Health in Phoenix, Arizona, and who has been in the field of oncology, she tells me, for now more than 24 years, an enormous amount of experience. So very excited to have these phenomenal colleagues with me tonight so that we can go over some of the most recent data on preserving fertility, on helping patients, you know, achieve their family planning goals, and how that intersects with their breast cancer care. Okay, and now I'm going to hand the mic over to the lovely Michelle Taylor for considerations for fertility preservation in premenopausal women with hormone-positive breast cancer. Take it away.
Hello, everyone. I'm so glad to be here with you tonight. I hope you've had a great first day here at the conference. I'm going to open it up with a bit of an introduction about fertility in the breast cancer setting. We know that our treatments cause infertility. It can impact fertility for women, especially our drugs like the alkylating agents, cyclophosphamide, which is commonly used, The anthracycline doxorubicin, I'm sure you're all familiar with, right? We even have some data that while it may not impact fertility, the CDK4/6 inhibitors in our adjuvant setting, we know that it can cause fetal harm, right? And we have young women who are planning their lives when they get diagnosed with breast cancer, and this is a big interruption. So very necessary to have these discussions. We know that hormone receptor-positive breast cancer has a unique risk due to the long-term endocrine therapy treatment as well as the long-term risk that these patients have. Thankfully, there are advances in fertility preservation that provide viable options for our patients, and we'll get into those a little bit. But there are numerous physical and psychosocial risk factors that should be considered when discussing fertility, both before and after treatment for breast cancer. So here are the main examples of fertility preservation strategies. I think our gold standard is cryopreservation of a fertilized embryo or oocyte preservation. These treatments can be done prior to initiation of therapy. It might be hard to process a statement for some of us, but breast cancer is rarely an emergency. So if we're talking about just typically 10 to 14 days needed to stimulate ovaries, typically with FSH or LH, at least in our community, we have that time, right? The data initially showed that this started at, you know, after the menstrual cycle begins, but a lot of the fertility specialists, they will do like a random start stimulation of ovaries. We know that that induces a high estrogen level briefly, and some providers will use an AI or tamoxifen to mitigate that risk, and there is more time than just the 10 to 14 days. I don't want to minimize that. It does take, you know, at least a week sometimes to get into a fertility specialist. Hopefully you can have these collaborative relationships where they'll prioritize your patients to be seen and get this started. Once the ovaries are stimulated and follicular stage is induced, the oocytes can be harvested by ultrasound and then either fertilized in vitro, if it's an embryo that we're going to cryopreserve, or they will just freeze that preserved, that mature oocyte for later use. Another step that we'll use is ovarian suppression, and I think this is much more common, especially if you have a low resource population like I do that may not have insurance coverage for fertility preservation. Unfortunately, the average cost of each cycle of fertility preservation is $8,000 to $12,000, depending on where you're at. That's for each cycle. And then if those women have success, it's about $500 to $1,000 per year to store those eggs or embryos. So back to ovarian suppression. This may protect ovarian function during chemotherapy. Essentially, you're using a GnRH agonist such as gosterolin to suppress ovarian function, essentially putting them to sleep. And you try to institute that at least 1 to 2 weeks prior to chemotherapy, and then certainly through chemotherapy, even for your triple negative breast cancer patients who are considering fertility, childbearing after. There's uncertain long-term fertility benefits, but most women will regain their menstrual function, especially if they're below age 35. And even there's some data that the majority will regain menstrual function between age 30 or 40, although once you get past 35, success tends to drop. And certainly past 40. Our fertility colleagues, our gyn colleagues, they start to worry about women 35 and up, right? And so if you think about what that means for a woman who's diagnosed at 35, maybe hasn't had a child or at least plans to have more, this delay in care, right? So there is ovarian tissue cryopreservation at all. I have not seen this done yet. This is kind of our cutting edge treatment, at least where we're at, where there's a surgical procedure to actually remove strips of ovarian tissue and cryopreserve that to later be reimplanted. Now, that's going to be right for some women and wrong for others. There's a cost issue. For your BRCA patients, this really isn't a viable option. And right now, the data shows this is about 40% successful. There are alternative family building options as well, such as egg donation, surrogacy, and adoption, which present their own challenges. So we do have some data to support that women can have successful pregnancies after breast cancer treatment. This is, again, for our hormone receptor-positive premenopausal women. This study Ann Partridge looked at pausing endocrine therapy. They took women who were premenopausal, aged 42 or less, who had had a minimum of 18 and no more than 30 months of endocrine therapy. They were given the opportunity to interrupt endocrine therapy for 2 years to attempt, achieve, and hopefully deliver a successful pregnancy, and then breastfeed if that was desirable or feasible. There was success. About three-fourths of patients in the trial did get pregnant, and about 90% of those women who got pregnant had a live birth. That's really exciting. I was just listening to Neil Love, and Dr. Meyer was on there, and she really, highlighted that was 317 babies. That's a really successful trial with a great endpoint, right? There was no increase in short-term recurrence risk. As Dr. Schatzky said, that our data, the last update is about at the three-year mark. Thankfully, these women have done well so far. You can't really randomize this kind of trial. You know, you can't randomize pregnancy or not pregnancy, right? So these women were compared to, matched women in the soft and text trials, and they did not have an increased risk compared, which was quite good news for a lot of our women that we take care of. So the implication for your clinic is that temporary endocrine therapy interruption can be safe for pregnancy. Now, the POMS trial, this was to evaluate what we discussed briefly is the use of a GnRH agonist for ovarian protection during chemotherapy. They randomized premenopausal women with hormone receptor negative early breast cancer to chemotherapy plus gosterolin versus chemotherapy alone. In this trial, it was given at the 3.6 milligram dose, sub-Q, Q 4 weeks, but if I'm correct, the NCCN guidelines does allow you to give that higher dose above 10 milligrams every 8 weeks. The findings were that they had lower ovarian failure risk, 8% versus 22% in the control arm, a higher pregnancy rate, essentially doubled the pregnancy rate, And then there was no adverse impact on survival overall. The clinical implications for this, again, is that we can use the GnRH agonists such as glycerolin, loperamide, for ovarian protection. It reduces the risk of chemotherapy-related ovarian failure. So when you're thinking about your fertility considerations for your women, NCCN does tell you, please start discussing this with your women at diagnosis, which can be overwhelming. They're already overwhelmed, especially if they're seen in a multidisciplinary clinic where they're seeing multiple providers on day one. But it is necessary, especially for our younger women. I mean, breast cancer robs these women of so much. And if there's an opportunity to give them the opportunity for family planning later, I think that's just crucial. Early consultation with fertility specialists is important. I think our larger centers do have oncofertility specialists. In my community practice in Phoenix, it's more collaborative care with other providers in the community. You have to find those one or two specialists, just like you do for GI or pulmonology, that will collaborate with you to prioritize and take care of your women. Be aware of barriers such as cost. I'm not aware of any grants out there, at least not in Arizona, that help our women. I have about a third of my patients are low socioeconomic Hispanic women, for example. These women are just as interested in family planning as any of us, and they often don't have access to this. Thankfully, we've had many successes with the use of glycerolin for ovarian protection, but that's not gold standard. It should not replace the option for cryopreservation. That's important if your patient can access that care. And then assessing their patient's physical, psychosocial, and economic, we discussed economic challenges, but there are a lot of physical and psychosocial challenges. Dr. McCann will speak about this later, but the major side effects that come with endocrine therapy, one to pull out, of course, is sexual dysfunction, which is very uncomfortable to talk about with your patients, but should always be talked about up front. Not just contraception during chemotherapy, but the long-term effects of sexual dysfunction that will certainly impact their childbearing planning, family planning. So shared decision-making and plan of care development is also really important. We want certain things for our patients. They often want something else. Dr. Schatzky just had a pretty incredible example of that. So we know that in our current age of healthcare, we should be incorporating what patients want. The data that they read, our breast cancer patients can often be very educated, and they had plans prior to this diagnosis. So partnering with them and letting them know that you're their partner, it really does help them along their journey. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Michelle. That was lovely. And just to give a little bit of attention to what she mentioned, yes, you know, this happens day to day. You can't predict exactly what your patients are going to do, right? It's their bodies and they're going to make their own decisions. You know, I got a message very recently that a patient of mine was dead set on getting pregnant. This patient was triple negative, and within 2 years, unfortunately, so I generally like to have my patients wait at least, you know, the positive trial was 18 months. I usually advise them around 2 years, depending on their risk category. And I got a message about a year out that she is pregnant already. And that happened tonight. So you never know with these things. And you kind of roll with the punches. But I do love and want to give attention to also one thing she said about identifying a provider in your community who is willing to partner with you to provide this really fast sort of collaboration for fertility preservation, because getting these patients in a timely manner is absolutely key. Finding that person who you can call up, you know, just pick up the phone and say, hey, I have a cancer patient here and she needs to see you immediately so that we can start egg stimulation and retrieval, because that timing really makes a great difference. Because with emergent or urgent referrals, you can get these patients in and you can get their egg stimulation and harvesting within 2 weeks, really, if everything is done on a really key timeline like that that you've identified in the community. You know, academic centers do have the advantage of those people and relationships being set up, but it doesn't mean it can't happen in the community as well. And so, you know, Dr. McCann and I practice in California, and there are some grants that we know of that can support the cost of this. Now, they don't do it for free, though. I mean, even with grants, these are costs that are brought down from maybe $10,000 to $5,000. So, I mean, this is an expensive process, and hopefully one day all of this will be covered by insurance, but currently it is not, and there are challenges. So, you know, those who can afford, that is wonderful. Those who can't, we support in what they can do. And insurance will cover a GnRH agonist that you can start before treatment so that you can at least, you know, put the ovaries to sleep and minimize the impact of the cytotoxic therapy that you are prescribing if the patient desires future childbearing. But that conversation needs to happen at that first visit for every single female who is under the age of 50. 55, someone should even say, but, you know, really it's very important that you not count anybody out for this discussion because there are all methods of family planning as well. I've had patients do every single permutation of this and it worked out. And, you know, these are wonderful situations that, you know, you would never imagine could exist and they do. So, you know, thank you for that, Ms. Taylor. And we're going to go on now, do a quick case in between here. So this is the case of Cindy. Cindy's a 34-year-old female, and she presents with a palpable mass in the right breast and on her diagnostic mammogram and ultrasound and breast MRI. It shows a 4-centimeter mass and 4 suspicious lymph nodes in the axilla. The biopsy confirms invasive ductal carcinoma, grade 3. The estrogen receptor is 98% positive, 3+. Progesterone receptor is negative, and HER2 is 1+ in both the breast and the lymph node. So, you know, younger patients, we know that the younger you are with breast cancer, the more aggressive and the worse outcomes it can be. And so this is sort of a pretty typical case for someone this young. CT scans of the body are negative for any evidence of distant metastatic disease. That's really important in this patient population because if you don't look, you'd be surprised what you can miss in a young patient. And then Cindy and her partner have not yet had children, and they were actively trying to conceive when she was diagnosed. Some people will kind of forget that transition point here, that so they've done their egg retrieval. We allowed them to take the 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes up to a month, to complete that. And remember, breast cancer is almost never an emergency. There are very few cases where you can't take the time to allow that to happen. You know, we have outcome data that shows that allowing patients to do their egg retrieval up front does not impact their outcome. And that's really important because I know that, you know, all patients sitting with you, just like every single new patient sitting with me says, we need to start this as soon as possible. You know, we let that anxiety sort of take control and rule the room there. But making sure that you have a comprehensive discussion about this for every single patient who desires future fertility or family planning is really important because you do have time for that. It is, you know, an important step in their care. But after they do their egg retrieval, it's still important that we consider a GnRH agonist prior to start of their therapy, because what if that egg retrieval wasn't very successful? What if their embryos, they don't survive a thaw? You know, we want to make sure that we preserve every option for a patient who is desiring future fertility. So you don't want to prioritize one step and forget the next one. Both of them are really important. Okay, and now I'm going to hand off the microphone to my good friend, Dr. Kelly McCann.
All right, so I'm going to talk about optimizing outcomes for GnRH agonists in the management of premenopausal women. So switching topics just slightly. So this is a study by Pan et al. That always is impressive to me. It's the risk of distant recurrence on the left and of death from ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer over time. And one of the points that I make with my patients is that this can come back over the next decades. That's very important because a lot of people come in and they think, I get to the 5-year mark, I'm cured. And if you give them the 5-year survival data for an ER-positive cancer, of course it's fantastic. And so why would they do any other endocrine therapy? And the reason is because we're looking at the long term when we're looking at ER-positive breast cancer. So in these curves, the yellow is with node-negative disease, the blue is N1 to 3, and then the red are the N4 to 9 patients. The Softentex trials studied ovarian function suppression plus or minus either tamoxifen or exemestane versus tamoxifen alone. And it was found that the ovarian function suppression improved disease-free survival. This is data that was the patients followed out for 8 years, and the disease-free survival at that time point with tamoxifen was 71% versus 76.7% with tamoxifen plus ovarian function suppression and 80% with exemestane plus ovarian function suppression. When they followed out this data to a longer time point, this is the 12-year data that was published in 2023. This shows that ovarian function suppression plus AI was superior to ovarian function suppression plus tamoxifen. The far left graph is disease-free survival. The middle graph is distant recurrence-free survival, and then overall survival on the far right. And that data we'll see will probably separate out eventually, but it's a little premature. Just going to speak to the fact that ER-positive patients recur later, and so the benefit of an adjuvant therapy you're not going to see until you follow them out for quite a long time. In the NCCN guidelines, there are multiple ways to do ovarian function suppression. Gasarolin, up until fairly recently, it's the only FDA-approved drug for ovarian function suppression in women at 3.6 milligrams every 4 weeks. The NCCN recently added to their guidelines that the 10.8 milligrams every 12 weeks is also acceptable. Part of that data came out of us having to give patients that every 3-month dosage during COVID. And so we finally had enough real-world data to say, yeah, it's fine to give that every 3 months, gasarolin. Gasarolin is given through a very large bore needle as a subcutaneous implant, which is incredibly important to tell patients. Usually it's a chemo nurse and a chemo chair when they're giving that. The leuprolide, which is approved for prostate cancer, of course, and has never been FDA approved for women, has been given to patients at 3.75 to 7.5 milligrams every 4 weeks, or you could give them the 11.25 to 22.5 milligram dose every 12 weeks. Leuprolide can be given by your medical assistant, and so if a patient's coming in and they're needing leuprolide and denosumab, that's a really easy appointment for them to go through. And then there's also triptorelin, which is 3.75 every 4 weeks. You could take the ovaries out. I have that discussion with my patients if they're close to menopause age and they're not going to want to be on some ovarian function suppression for 5 years. They're very close to going through menopause anyway. I've never referred anyone for radiation so far, but it's also an option in the NCCN guidelines. When we're starting ovarian function suppression, we mentioned starting it before chemotherapy for fertility preservation. If it is being used as an adjuvant therapy, then ideally it should be started 1 to 2 cycles or even concurrently with tamoxifen until the estradiol level is undetectable or in the postmenopausal range, and then the aromatase inhibitor can be added on. The duration of ovarian function suppression in the Softex trials was 5 years optimally, but a minimum of 2 years is encouraged. And there so far is no data to support going beyond that 5 years. So I think that part of the struggle in all of our clinics who are treating hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer is that the rate of discontinuation of adjuvant hormonal therapy is very, very high. So this is data from a patient population of almost 9,000 early stage patients at Kaiser with hormone receptor positive breast cancer who filled at least one prescription for endocrine therapy. So sometimes we get those patients who come in, they hear our advice, and they never come back. These are patients who filled the first prescription. In the middle are the tamoxifen-only patients. The yellow is the number or the percentage of patients who were perfectly compliant daily dosing of the therapy. The blue are patients who didn't take it daily as recommended. And then the red are patients who discontinued therapy. On the far right, those bars, you can see in red, that's discontinuation of an aromatase inhibitor. And you can see as you go year to year, year one all the way through year five, that the discontinuation rate of AI is increasing. So in these graphs at the far right, you can see through this blue line that this is the proportion of patients who continued therapy, and it decreases with increasing years. Factors that are associated with poor adherence to endocrine therapy are multifold. One is related to the therapy itself. There are adverse events, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Another is the complexity of treatment, and that's important to think about now that we have also the added CDK4/6 inhibitor burden. Patients are now maybe on ovarian function suppression, and they're getting their labs drawn, and they're having side effects for an aromatase inhibitor, and maybe they need to be on a bisphosphonate because they're having decreased bone density. Cost of medication is also incredibly important. Patient-related predictors, a lack of belief in treatment is a big one. So when I talk to my patients about having breast cancer, I usually spend a good hour with them trying to talk to them about where to put their diagnosis and the scaffold of all the information that is going to be pouring in, because they all come in having Googled their diagnosis and they know a lot. They know other patients who have had breast cancer. And so if they don't believe in your treatment, of course they're not going to take your treatment. There are often psychosocial problems, especially depression, after a young woman has developed a breast cancer diagnosis. Sometimes they forget to take the drug. There is poor awareness of the benefit of recurrence risk. If you're only thinking out 5 years and not 20 years, then you're not going to see the benefit of taking that medication. And then younger age can be a predictor of poor adherence. There are also healthcare provider related issues, such as a poor patient healthcare provider relationship, a lack of discussion of possible adherence problems or adverse events, and then the lack of time, which we all suffer from. Predictors of poor adherence include missed appointments and inadequate follow-up and unfilled prescriptions. So some of the recommendations would be consult the patient on their preferences. So I have patients who I can start on letrozole. They have joint stiffness. I go to an exemestane, and then I go to tamoxifen. And sometimes they're worried about that, and sometimes they're not. I always tell them that my favorite therapy for them is the one that they're going to take instead of just quitting therapy altogether. So we need improved patient education and counseling. Ideally, we'd have enough time to counsel our patients. And then also strong support and management of side effects. Menopausal symptoms, of course, affect multiple organ systems. This is especially hard for a premenopausal woman who went from full estrogen straight into menopause. And so there are a lot of things that we can do as oncologists and take over management for, such as osteoporosis, weight gain. I have started referring, occasionally I've referred obese patients. Some patients have insomnia and anxiety, and it helps to validate their feelings and what side effects they're going through. For fatigue and musculoskeletal symptoms, exercise is quite helpful. And then for cardiovascular toxicity, I remind them they've also got to worry about their heart health, eat a healthy diet. If their lipids are high, I might refer out to their primary care provider or to a cardiologist. And then some of the other symptoms, such as vasomotor symptoms and vaginal dryness, can be especially bothersome. And there are many therapies that we can use here. Some of them are not pharmaceutical remedies, but if we go through some of those pharmaceutical remedies that I use most often, they include gabapentin, especially for the patient who can't sleep, whose hot flashes are worse at night, Effexor if they're having low energy or having some symptoms of depression. Oxybutynin can work really well. And then there are some other options included in the SSRI category. For managing vaginal dryness, I often work with my gyn-onc colleagues. Theoretically, we should be trying to exhaust the therapies that aren't hormonal before we start going over to the hormonal-based intravaginal options. And so I work very closely with my colleagues on that. And with that, we'll do case number two.
Okay, thank you for that, Dr. McCann. We're a little bit over time, but I'm just going to go quickly through this. So Lily is a 32-year-old female with a history of a PT2N1A grade 2 invasive ductal carcinoma, highly ERPR positive, HER2 negative. She underwent bilateral mastectomy and sentinel lymph node biopsy for her cancer in 2023. And she got adjuvant dose dense ACT, nodal radiation, and has been on gasarolin and letrozole for 19 months. Lily asks you if she can pause her endocrine therapy to try and conceive, as she is her, and her husband have 5 frozen embryos, and she was able to retrieve those prior to the start of her chemotherapy. So how would you counsel Lily on her request? I'm going to go with my my two colleagues here first.
I have a microphone. I can make this work. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Well, we would support Lily in her request. I mean, she's not at that 24-month mark, so I would talk to her about waiting. I'm sorry, I didn't catch Lily's age.
32 years old.
Okay, so we got a little bit of a leeway there. We would, you know, we do know that the update with the positive trial, if I'm not mistaken, was that women who did seek out in vitro fertilization, there was not an increased risk after they did update that at the last SABCS, or the year before, excuse me. So I would probably support her moving forward.
Dr. McCann?
These are incredibly nuanced conversations to have. If you have a patient who could have a surrogate, then sometimes we talk about that. And those can be very long appointments because you're planning out children with your patient and they're sometimes with their spouse as well. So I would counsel her to try and get at least 2 years in, of course. And I also say to my patients, you know, even if your ovaries start to lose fertility at 35, you still have a uterus, and your uterus is good forever until it turns against
theoretically.
So
yeah, no, it is true. When you have embryos on ice, you know, your clock is not quite as rushed as someone who maybe does not, and so there are more options. I've actually had patients consider what we call the one and done, which is some of my patients recently have been doing intra vitro fertilization when they're ready to pause their endocrine therapy, and then actually transferring 2 embryos because they want to do this once. They're excited about the idea of twins and restarting their endocrine therapy, and, you know, perhaps are not excited about, you know, starting and stopping, and then at their age maybe starting and stopping again, because that's not something that we have necessarily long-term data for. And one of the questions the audience asked, actually, that I'm going to address right now is, how long were patients followed for in the positive trial? And I want to be very clear about this, too. The data is not long enough to say long-term that we're not going to have a higher rate of distant relapse in the long-term spectrum. But what we know so far is that in the 3-year follow-up that we have that was presented by Dr. Partridge, who is truly the world's expert in, you know, premenopausal breast cancer fertility, along with Matteo Lambertini and the Italian group, you know, we don't have very long follow-up for these patients. So there's more to be discussed, certainly, as we follow these patients longer. But for now, you know, what we can share with patients is, hey, this is the data that exists. This is a risk versus benefit conversation. You know, I can't assure you that this is safe, but this is something that if this is really important to you and your family, you know, this is up to you. It's a personal decision, ultimately. The positive trial actually did allow patients to stop their endocrine therapy at 18 months. You know, I don't necessarily encourage everyone right at that moment that that's when they should do it if they're going to. But technically, they allowed patients to stop at 18 months, and they allowed up to 30 months for that window.
You know, these were younger patients too. They were patients under the age of 40 generally, because what I've found in these conversations as well is that a lot of patients, when we start these conversations, really didn't understand just how much their fertility goes down at age 35. Once we actually look at those graphs and start talking to a reproductive endocrinologist, we see that there is a significant drop-off that a lot of patients just had not realized because they hadn't taken the time to start planning their future fertility. Because women are having, you know, babies later in life these days. But once you get to the age 40, the chance of live pregnancy goes way down, and the chance of miscarriage and chromosomal abnormalities actually goes way up. And then at 45 and up, the chance of live birth is extremely rare. And so these are really important conversations to have then and now before you embark on this long journey of hormone-positive endocrine therapy.
Right. I think patients are younger. I mean, they're delaying pregnancies till later in life, often into their early 40s, as well as they're being diagnosed younger with breast cancer. So it's this, you know, two sides of the coin. And I also want to point out, and at least in we approach it, that two-year mark in general is hopefully for some psychosocial settling too after having a breast cancer diagnosis. So the scientific data, but also the psychosocial data, unfortunately, relationships often collapse. I mean, I've had more than one patient who did bank their embryos. They went fertilized embryo and then had a divorce during pregnancy, I mean, during breast cancer treatment. I mean, we see these sad stories, so we got to keep that in mind too.
Absolutely. And just to go on here, so I very clearly stated too, with the caveat that we don't have long-term follow-up yet, and that does need to be stated, data from the positive trial so far has shown that outcomes for women with hormone-positive breast cancer who pause their endocrine therapy after taking it for at least 18 months and then try to conceive and then resume therapy after delivery are not worse when we look at our counterparts who they used the control arm here as the women in the Softentex trials. And for our fellows out there, this was ovarian suppression with tamoxifen or exemestane in the Softentex trials versus tamoxifen alone. And so that was sort of the comparator group here, knowing that this was, you know, a registrational non-randomized trial with we're never going to have exact prospective data here. That is phase three randomized. That's just not the way that fertility works.
I think it's also key to say that 3 years out, the recurrence rate was 8%.
Yeah, and it's not that, nothing. It's, and that was the soft infection. And so that's why 9%.
When I counsel patients, I don't say it's safe to have a baby after 2 years. I say this is the data we have so that they are informed to make that decision on their own. I mean, if you're going to be a new mom and you know, you have a almost one in 10 chance of basically developing metastatic disease at 3 years. And you know that rate's going to go up. And that's really important for their planning.
Absolutely. And so the last point I want to make, too, is that there was a recent letter in JAMA about patients on this trial and the outcomes when patients did not resume their endocrine therapy. And we are starting to see worse outcomes in that group. And so it is extremely important when I have these discussions with my patients that we discuss that resuming endocrine therapy post delivery is essential. This isn't, you know, because can you imagine, you know, you have a new baby, you're feeling loss of control in so many different ways. And the idea of restarting your endocrine therapy, which didn't make you feel so great in the first place, is extremely overwhelming. And so these expectations and guidelines for patients as far as their actual outcomes need to be stated pretty definitively up front, I've found, because that's essential to their care. It's we're not seeing the same outcomes already for those who did not resume their endocrine therapy. And we are, as I kind of expected with this trial, seeing that there's a significant amount of patients who really don't want to resume their therapy. And so those, and that caveat, I think, needs to be really described and discussed in detail before all of this is decided as a group decision with patient and physician. Okay, we're going to do that post-session survey. There's one other thing I wanted to add as far as as far as management of postmenopausal symptoms as well, is that something that's been a game changer over the last year in my patients who are experiencing hot flashes, or hot flushes, whatever you want to call them, this is not an endorsement necessarily, because there's an entire class that is now being used in this therapy, is the first drugs that have been looked at specifically for hot flushes for postmenopausal women are the neurokinin 3 receptor antagonist, the fezolinetant. I can never say that quite ready, but its brand name is Veozah.
It's an incredible drug.
Yeah, it has been a game changer for many of my patients. It's a pill that they take once daily. It's non-hormonal, and it can, compared to some of the therapies that we have seen, you know, actually is far superior. And so that has been, there's several other that are being investigated in clinical trials right now, and I look forward to those reaching market as well, because this is something that, while you do have to prove to insurance companies right now that the patient has tried other options, if you can get it approved by insurance, has been a really big improvement in quality of life for many different patients. You know, I don't use a lot of Paxil or paroxetine in my practice because it has a very bad withdrawal. And I'm the same thing for Effexor as well. I find that the withdrawal when patients do want to come off can be really, really difficult. And so something that patients can take that doesn't give them the horrible withdrawal symptoms and is specifically designed for that purpose has been a really nice improvement as far as this patient all hormone positive patient population's quality of life.
But before you prescribe it, price it out too.
Yeah.
Because it's
very expensive.
A bit much.
I'm hoping all of those will improve as this field takes off and as there's competitors in the market.
But right. We're having success with the copay card, though. If they're non-Medicare, it's $30. So, and it has made a great difference. Low side effect profile. Women report near resolution.
You do need to monitor LFTs.
Yes, monitor LFTs at least every 6 months. But many of them are reporting near resolution, if not resolution of hot flashes within a week, at least in our practice. And then when they have refractory hot flashes, we've been using it for a year or two. Some of them kind of break through. We pause it for a couple of weeks and then restart it.
Yeah.
And they seem to have that same initial effect.
Yeah,
I mean,
have sort of that tachyphylaxis that we see with some drugs, which is interesting.
Right.
Okay. And then I think, there was another question from the audience that I'd like to address too. So I'm going to give this one to you guys first too as well. It was a question of, it seems that all of these conversations are starting with the medical oncologist. Should maybe they start with the surgical oncologist instead of the medical oncologist? And so, you know, I'm going to give that to you guys to answer.
We usually do a multidisciplinary tumor board and do a lot of handoffs that are direct with each other so that we can reinforce each other's recommendation plans. Mm-hmm. And so if a patient's going in to see a radiation oncologist and they haven't seen me in follow-up for a long time because they don't want to go on an aromatase inhibitor, then the radiation oncologist can say heads up to me and also encourage the patient to go as well. So I think with a multidisciplinary team, it can be very, very encouraging to the patient to hear
multiple.
Yeah.
Right. Providers say the same thing, yeah. I think it really just depends also on how your practice model is designed, you know, whether mm-hmm. the patient is seeing surgery first and going to surgery first, or if they're planned to have neoadjuvant chemotherapy. You know, in the patients that are referred to me because they're going to get neoadjuvant therapy, I usually take care of the oncofertility referrals. But in patients who are going to surgery first for smaller tumors, I usually have them have surgery and then do their egg retrieval stimulation after surgery, but before, say, radiation and hormonal therapy. And so it also depends if you have a multidisciplinary clinic where people see everybody at once the same day, too, who you want to have talk about it, or if you want to have everybody talk about it.
Right. I think in community more often they're going to see a surgical oncologist first.
Yeah.
We also, you know, we have two surgeons in house. We do multidisciplinary, but when they're coming from referrals, our one surgical oncologist who sees most of our younger patients, she will address it and she's quite good at it. As she's so good, sometimes I'm like, well, we can help. You know, like, let us do some of the medical stuff. But yeah, I think that's a really good point about the surgical oncologist.
When would you allow vaginal estrogen therapy? You knew you were going to get that when you...
We were just talking about it.
Yeah.
I try to avoid that as much as we can. I know that they're, you know, the gynecology field really loves, they will outright prescribe estrogen to your patients if you haven't had that happen, vaginal and systemic. We know that there was some systemic absorption of the vaginal estrogen, even at low doses. Those patients on the trial had lower cholesterol level, I mean, better cholesterol levels and better bone health. There are patients, our older patients with severe recurrence of UTIs and incontinence and that will do it for certain periods, but we really try to avoid that. We emphasize hyaluronic estrogen inserts or creams, coconut oil, pelvic floor therapy, anything we can do prior to that.
And if you switch them over to tamoxifen, then it's safe to do intravaginal estrogen, so I do that sometimes as well.
Okay, these are some questions about the positive trial data. It says, resuming endocrine therapy after pregnancy, what was the total years of endocrine therapy received? So if the planned endocrine therapy was 5 years, then it was 5 years. If the planned endocrine therapy, you know, if say they were on tamoxifen before, then they were supposed to continue out their 10 years if they had planned that. So it was based on the original plan that was brought up by the oncologist, but a minimum was 5 years.
A little short.
I want to thank all three of you.
Yeah.
Are we on? I want to thank all three of you for a really fantastic discussion of a very, very important issue. I've been in practice long enough to know that it's great when we get babies along the way. It's really fantastic. Yes. I do want to bring up, someone mentioned the GLP-1 agonist, Ozempic or Wegovy, for weight loss. This is not a fertility issue, but a side effect issue. And I have a significant number of patients now on these drugs, and we are seeing other benefits besides weight loss. Decrease in hemoglobin A1C, decrease in the lipid profiles, improvement of the overall metabolic syndrome, decrease in inflammation, actually decrease in inflammatory markers. We know that in obesity-related cancers, these drugs are already showing benefits in reducing incidence and recurrence. We're hoping that this may be true in our hormone receptor positive breast cancer patients who are suffering from metabolic syndrome because of these endocrine therapies. So I'd like to put that into the air that we need to do some clinical research on that as well.
Absolutely.
I completely agree.
I mean,
yeah.
Estrogen's made in fat tissue, and when we developed things like the aromatase inhibitors in the 80s, 90s, the people's body mass index was not what it is today, and we have these flat doses. Are we actually suppressing them to a significant degree? It's a tough...
Right.
We emphasize so much. I'm a big checker of the high sensitivity estradiol levels in my patients on ovarian suppression, and when I have a difficult time suppressing, you know, and getting them below at least 20, but getting them even below 10, I will refer to weight loss physicians for this because a lot of it is peripheral conversion.
Right.
And that is a significant issue. And I do think as we study this, you know, one of the physicians who's presenting at this meeting, Neil Lyongar, who is at Sloan Kettering, there's a lot of
wonderful, he's done some preliminary work.
Work in. And so this is, while we don't have great data at the moment, I really am looking forward to seeing that in the future.
Yeah.
Right. We know that the science of, you know, obesity is and metabolic syndrome.
Right.
We talk about lifestyle so much with our patients, and we still want to encourage that. But we know it's not that easy, especially if they're on an AI.
Exactly.
I mean, it is so difficult, and they get so discouraged. So, you know, maybe 5 years ago, we were a little leery of these medicines, but now we certainly support it. The primaries will submit our notes to help them get it approved.
Right.
And we're seeing major success with our women, you know, less of many of the side effects. Not just
exactly,
and we do have 20 years of safety data in the diabetic populations. These aren't new.
Right.
We've been using Trulicity and all of
those
for a fair amount of time now. And, you know, people had such concerns about thyroid cancer. That has not panned out.
I've seen reversal of fatty liver.
Exactly. We have data now that it's decreased the incidence of so many different obesity-related cancers.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Right.
Yeah. Great point.
Thanks.
Great
That's point. A great point. Thank you. Okay. And so someone said, I thought patients who became pregnant actually had a lower risk of recurrence compared to individuals that were not able to conceive. Did I not read the study correctly? So I can answer that one. So there was a slight numerical lower chance or lower recurrence rate in those who became pregnant, but it was not statistically significant between the two groups of those who were on the Softentex trial versus those in the positive trial at 3-year follow-up. There's very close 8-9%.
Right. The science of pregnancy, right? You would think theoretically that there, you know, because the estrogen levels do drop, and we know that the risk factors for breast cancer are those who have, you know, that long-term estrogen exposure and nulliparity and all of that. So, I mean, the data is maybe not there, but I think theoretically we think that there's, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but just the science around pregnancy, it's same thing with with the estrogen receptor positive patients. When they go, it's not this equivalent to ovarian removal. I don't want to say it like that at all. I'm starting to babble here a little bit, but I think theoretically there's some science there, right?
Okay. And then in high-risk premenopausal women who start AI and ovarian suppression for 5 years, this is more of a general question. Do you just switch to TAM after 5 years if not sure if they are still premenopausal? Well, I can tell you my approach to that is if I don't know if they're postmenopausal because they're, say, in their 50s, mid-50s, after I've done ovarian suppression, I give it a trial. I'll stop their ovarian suppression, and I will measure serial estradiols on their aromatase inhibitor, because if they are not postmenopausal, it'll go up. Mm-hmm. You know, those are we use aromatase inhibitors as fertility drugs in reproductive endocrinology to stimulate ovarian function. So if you don't, if a woman is not fully into menopause, and that is not the same as, you know, OB-GYNs used to say of just having the absence of your period for 1 year. It really isn't as far as breast cancer is concerned, because we're stimulating their ovarian function. So I will check serial estradiols on an aromatase inhibitor, and if it starts to go up, you have your answer. Then immediately you put them back on.
Do you transition patients to tamoxifen after?
We haven't really done a lot of that. It depends on the patient. It depends on their overall risk. In an N3 patient, have I encouraged them to have an oophorectomy? Yeah. Right. I'm really concerned. You know, N3 has terrible outcomes. In someone who is more of a lower risk situation, have I done 5 years of tamoxifen, or have I just stopped at 5 years? I've done all of the above. So it's a group shared decision making based on overall risk.
Right.
Okay. And then is there a role, this is a little out of there, for ctDNA testing or restaging scans prior to pregnancy?
The question of ctDNA is so tough in general.
You know, like I know that most of us, at least in academic pregnancy, academic breast cancer, are not there as far as ctDNA monitoring recurrence in most patients at this point, because we don't know that that actually has an impact on outcomes in any way.
Right.
But as far as restaging scans prior to pregnancy, in my own practice, I actually will do that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have one of my patients who's actually has occult metastatic disease go on and get pregnant and not know it. So I will order scans to make sure they don't have visible metastatic disease at that point. Have I done ctDNA in that situation? No. I mean, if a patient and their physician made that joint decision, you know, would I judge them on that? No. But right now in my practice, I have had patients do this, and I have ordered scans for them to make sure they don't have occult metastatic disease.
Or overt metastatic disease, basically, if it's on a scan.
Oh, yes, sorry. Gross metastatic disease.
Mm-hmm. So the problem with ctDNA...
Occult, meaning that we didn't know it was there.
Yeah. If you order ctDNA and it's negative, that doesn't mean that the patient doesn't have metastatic disease.
Okay.
We know there is poor compliance to endocrine therapy for the 5 years not in taking breaks for pursuing pregnancy. What is the percentage of patients who discontinued their endocrine therapy completely in the studies where they took a break for the pursuit of pregnancy? So you want to go?
In all clinical trials,
about 25% of patients, based on this JAMA letter that was published about 2 weeks ago, that were not resuming. And I mean, they still have time to, I would say, but it is a problem that is happening in this patient population, and that should be again discussed up front, as you know, that is something that is definitely going to increase their risk if they shorten. We know that less than 5 years of endocrine therapy, especially in a high-risk patient, and any young patient is high-risk by definition, you know, is a problem. And so, yes, that can increase overall this kind of non-compliance long-term endocrine strategy.
Right, that general non-compliance is something with all patients, whether they're seeking pregnancy or not, right? What is the national rate, like 40%,
it's
roughly?
It's about 35, 40%.
We tend to have a higher compliance rate in general just by going with, you know, please take it at least 4 days a week or take it at least 5 days a week to match the data that shows equivalency. But it's a tough, you know, tough drug. I mean, we have plenty of patients that are only taking it 2-3 days a week, which is like a data-free zone, so... Yeah. I don't know what you guys do in that situation.
There was a study with exemestane, and they looked at, because the half-life of these drugs is actually kind of long. Like tamoxifen, if you're going to do FES PET or you're going to say, go ahead and get pregnant, you're going to wait for a few months for it to be out of their system. So we know that the half-life is long, but I don't recommend any alternative tamoxifen dosages right now. There was a study with exemestane 3 times a week, and it was equivalent to daily. Mm-hmm. And so... my patients will definitely round that one up and come in with it.
So there's some more questions that are getting into the ethical considerations of some of this. And these are tough because there's no right or wrong answer to this. Like I have one here that says, do you think that a patient with poor prognosis, we should help them get pregnant? And one says, with false expectations. So that's a little bit of a loaded question right there. But, you know... I think it's important that we don't, that we have very transparent discussions with patients about their prognosis. And so that's very important before that. But whether, I don't know if we would call it helping them get pregnant, you know, that's really up to them. And we can't presume to make those decisions for another woman and, or another family. You know, I have, for example, I've seen a whole spectrum as someone who does this routinely with young patients. I have a patient right now who, her and her husband, she's 31 years old. She was BRCA positive, and before she metastasized, she had embryos banked with her husband, and her family and her have decided, she now has metastatic disease. They have decided that the family wants to raise this baby, the husband and the family. And so they're pursuing surrogacy, and they're going to do this embryo transfer. It's not me making this decision. These are for a family to make, and we can't presume that we can control that. You know, that is not for us. So I think we need to be really clear as far as what our role is in all of this. Mm-hmm. We partner with patients, but we don't tell them what to do. We can tell them their prognosis, which, you know, in this situation, I've been very clear with my young patient that, you know, they have a very limited life expectancy of maybe 3 years at this point of where she is in her disease. And that they acknowledge that, and that every single member of the family who plans to raise that baby knows that. But that's ultimately their decision to partner with a reproductive endocrinologist to decide, not ours.
I try to make it, for my stage 3 patients who are very high risk for recurrence, and make it more concrete for them. If you recur while you're pregnant, what is this choice going to be in the first trimester? What's your choice going to be in the second, third trimester? Are you willing to go through chemotherapy like you did before, but pregnant this time, so that they can really think through that decision in less abstract terms?
Here's another one that's good. I have a triple negative breast cancer patient who's 34 years old, needs neoadjuvant chemotherapy. How much time do you allow to get fertility preservation before starting? So that's a good one. In general, I allow one cycle. So however long that takes, because again, I know we all jump, like think triple negative breast cancer, it's an emergency. You know, as a specialist in that disease, I would say it's not an emergency in most cases. You don't have to start that week. We know the outcomes are not different. And that's always important is when you're talking about clinical trials as well. Delaying the patient's start of chemotherapy by a week or two to go on a clinical trial that potentially provides better therapy than the standard of care doesn't make their prognosis worse. And same thing for fertility preservation. So what I tell them, now, if they can't get in to see someone for some reason, that's another thing you're going to have to discuss with them. But I allow no more than one cycle if you're going to do neoadjuvant therapy. And if that cycle's not great, well, hey, we're going to move on. You know, but that has been my kind of rule of thumb.
That's about the same. And then sometimes the question comes on the other end when they are in this phase of pausing their endocrine therapy. They're supposed to be in that 2-year window. It's been a year. They haven't gotten pregnant yet. We're starting to talk about, you know, what is that going to look like? And that can be a heartbreaking conversation on the other end.
If they are unable to get pregnant within mm-hmm. that window too, I kind of start urging them like, hey, we really need to restart here. I'm worried about you. I'm concerned about your outcome. I know right. you want this pregnancy, but you know, maybe pursuing adoption or something else is a better option for you, because there are a percentage of patients who will be unable to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And you've got to think about other alternatives for them if that's something that they feel really strongly about.
Right.
And then someone is adding to the comment about the GLP-1, tirzepatide is linked to vision loss and blindness. That's a conversation for a different talk, I would say. There's hundreds of thousands of people in the country and all over the world on those drugs right now. So whether you think they're safe or not is a different talk. With that decision, if the family have children with the genetics and have more risk to spread the cancer in the next generation. Yeah, so in my germline carrier patients, you have the option, and we highly encourage them to do pre-implantation genetic screening, where they can find eggs or that are negative for, say, the BRCA gene or TP53 or whatever gene you have, and implant or fertilize those eggs specifically. It's called PGS or PG, pre-implantation genetic screening. And so that is the preferred method for patients who carry germline mutations. You need to involve a genetic counselor and your reproductive endocrinologist together.
How do you counsel your patients that are BRCA positive who are delaying ovarian removal? You know, that can get really complicated. You know, you're trying to get them through their endocrine therapy. They're doing ovarian cancer screening with CA-125 ultrasounds, right? But then what?
Yeah. I mean, again, ultimately, it's a personal decision. We don't get to decide when someone's ovaries come out. It has to be their decision. But I start urging them, especially if they're BRCA1, like their risk goes up. At, you know, I would really like them to get their ovaries out by, you know, age 35. But do I have women who go way later than that? Yeah. And I have women who decided never to. This is, you know, we have bodily autonomy that we need to preserve here. It's not for us to make these decisions for the patient,
right?
But we counsel them about the risk.
Right.
As an infusion RN that is asked questions in the 100th hour, what is the percentage of patients in your studies that have a successful birth after harvesting prior to starting treatment? I've had some really great outcomes, to be honest. Like, it depends on the age of the patient. And I mean, you have certainly, you're going to have patients that were unsuccessful in their egg retrieval prior to treatment. And that happens. One cycle of IVF is not enough for a lot of people. And so that's a really tragic situation. They do one cycle, and then by the time they're ready, they really can't, you know, achieve another outcome as far as harvesting more eggs. But so it really just depends on the age of the patient and what their prior fertility was. That's a super variable amongst women in their 30s and 40s. We know after age 40, fertility outcomes go way down. Mm-hmm. After age 35, they go down. So when you're talking about your super young patients, it's quite a bit better. But we also, there's concern that maybe germline carriers overall have slightly worse fertility. Maybe for evolutionary reasons, but so that's a very variable one.
Okay, I think that is all of the questions. Well, thank you all for joining us tonight, and I appreciate everybody, especially for staying late with us. You know, we are all available if you wanted to ask more personal questions, but thank everybody for joining us.